Oh, man, I am about to give three lucky eaters so much free food. You'd almost think that this was like a time of year when people are apt to give other people free things. All right, three of you listeners are going to win this awesome prize pack, which includes Tasty Brand Fruit Gummies, Mary's Gone Crackers, Pop Chips, Love Grown Foods Oat Clusters, and gift certificates for Evol Burritos. That's right, burritos. Now, what do all these foods have in common? They are all featured in a new book by my friend Rachel Hofstetter, Cooking Up a Business, Lessons from Food Lovers Who Turned Their Passion into a Career, and How You Can Too. And in addition to winning all those foods, you also win a copy of the book. No purchase necessary to enter. All you have to do is sign up for the Sporkful mailing list by the stroke of midnight on New Year's Eve. To do that, just look in the right-hand column of Sporkful.com. And while you're there on the interwebs, pick up a copy of Rachel's book. It's called Cooking Up a Business.
This is The Sporkful.
This is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman, and we're about to challenge your assumptions about consumption and drop a sporkful of knowledge on you. Because we're obsessively compulsive about eating more awesomely, and because if history has taught us anything, it's that the hosts of food shows need a lot of catchphrases. Great show for you today with an old friend of The Sporkful, a return guest, and I'd like to welcome her now. She is Slate's food and drink editor, and she is Laura Anderson. Hey, Laura.
Hi, Dan.
Hey, welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be back in the studio with you.
Yes, and Slate fans may know you better as L.V. Anderson.
They may, and I know that you give me a lot of trouble about the fact that I go by two names, but I feel like most people can probably follow it pretty well if anyone's paying attention to me at all, which is, you know, who knows.
Oh, they are. They are. Especially with the premiere of your video series. You know, you've been writing, you're doing it wrong about mm-hmm. recipe series. Now you have the video series.
You now have videos called Do It Right.
And you demonstrate techniques.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah, and we actually got into a bit of a Twitter debate about your tomato slicing.
That's right. You have problems with my tomato slicing technique. You thought I should not slice vertically. You think you should always start horizontally. And my response is that if you're chopping a tomato, it doesn't really matter which direction you start with.
That is true. That is true. But do you agree that if you're slicing a tomato for a sandwich, it should be horizontal slices?
Absolutely, absolutely. Because if you slice vertically for a sandwich, you get some slices that are just full of like goo and seeds, and you get other slices that have like more tomato meat in them. But if you slice horizontally, you get a nice sort of even amount of seeds and meat in each slice.
That's right. But so my point though is, there's never a downside to slicing horizontally, but there's sometimes a downside to slicing vertically. So why not just, as your rule of thumb in your head, just say, I will always slice horizontally, and that way you'll never accidentally slice vertically when you're making a sandwich, because the last time you did it, you were cubing.
I mean, I don't ever accidentally slice vertically when I'm making a sandwich. You know, I'm present in the moment, and I think about what I'm doing, and, you know, I don't make mistakes like that. That's kind of a rookie mistake, Dan.
Before we get into the topic at hand, we should mention quickly that you have a really fascinating long-form piece of journalism that went up on Slate a few weeks ago. Slate has this cool thing called Frescas, where they take one of their writers and they say, we're taking away all your daily responsibilities for, how long, what is it, a month?
Yeah, 3 weeks or 4 weeks.
3 or 4 weeks, and we're going to send you off to work on some long-form journalism and get really in-depth on a certain story. And this was your first time doing that.
That's right.
And you wrote a really interesting story, so tell us what it's about.
It's about an adjunct professor at Duquesne University named Margaret Voitko, who died in September, and her story went viral, and I went to Pittsburgh to talk to people who knew her to try to find out more about who she was as an individual, and found out that she was a really fascinating person. So,
and as it turned out, the story, when you investigated it, was not as simple and straightforward as people originally thought.
Yeah, it was definitely a lot more complicated than people originally thought.
Well, congrats on your piece, and we'll link to it at sporkful.com.
Thanks, Dan.
Let's go ahead and jump into today's topic for mastication and rumination, which is breakfast potatoes. Now, right away, off the bat here, Laura, I feel like this episode is rife with controversy.
Well, breakfast potatoes is kind of a clunky phrase because it encompasses more than one kind of potato. There are lots of different ways of preparing, or I guess maybe two main ways of preparing potatoes for breakfast, and people have very different preferences about what they like there.
That's right. And that's why it's rife with controversy, because I feel a little bit hesitant about lumping these together. You know, we're all about the detail here on the Sporkful.
Mm-hmm.
But let's try to define our terms so we know what we're talking about. Now, I think of it, you said two categories. It's hash browns and home fries. To me, hash browns are shredded. Home fries are cubed.
That seems right. That seems like a very good basic definition. But then once you get into, for instance, okay, so hash browns are shredded. You know, latkes are also shredded. You have some hash browns that are sort of like little cakes of mushed up potato, almost like tater tots. Like, you know, you go to McDonald's and their hash browns are like this weird oblong rectangular oval type thing that is just like compressed. And then you have other hash browns that are sort of looser. So like, and then you have like tater tots. Like where do you draw the line between hash browns and these other shredded potato confections?
I feel like for hash browns, I want to say that they can't be fully fused together into a single structure.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be. Tater tots are a different thing. A McDonald's hash brown is not a proper hash brown.
Fair enough.
A potato latke has flour and is bound together. It has egg
in it, too.
Right,
yeah.
Right, and that's why it's also called a potato pancake.
Mm-hmm.
To me, potato pancake is a more apt term for that. Hash browns are just fried shredded potatoes. Now, maybe you add a few things, which we can get to.
But no binder, no flour, no egg.
That's right.
I'm curious if you have any thoughts on hash brown making technique, because you can just throw some shredded potatoes into a hot skillet with oil and they will sort of crisp up. But then how do you stir them so that you get something that is not fused together, but you do get crispy sorts of outsides? Because I feel like if you stir hash browns too much when you're making them, they don't really get very crispy.
That's a great point. I was thinking about that. Maybe then it's not that they can't be fused together. It's that there can't be a binding agent.
Okay. That sounds good.
If they fuse together naturally through the glorious process we call frying, then that's okay.
Okay.
You know, like, I don't know what the binding agent in McDonald's hash browns is, but I'm sure it's a few really long words.
It's like, yeah.
End in ATE hyphen number 47 or something.
I'm sure you're right about that. I think that's true. I feel like most of the hash browns that I've seen are fused together just by the virtue of having been fried together. You mentioned before the two different categories, home fries and hash browns. I'm not a huge hash brown fan. If I have a choice between hash browns and home fries, I'll go with the home fries.
Really?
And that's because I don't, just like the inside of hash browns just don't taste that good to me. You get some, it seems like they're always slightly undercooked, almost a little bit crunchy, the little shreds of potato. And like the outside is great because it's crispy and fried, but the inside is just like potato goop with some like sort of al dente bits of potato in there.
But I would counter by saying home fries are always going to have a soft potato interior.
Right, but it's going to be consistent. It's going to be all the same kind of perfect potato softness. Whereas I find that hash browns, there's this variation. So you have some parts of the shred of potato that are too soft, and then you have other parts that are too hard. And it just doesn't satisfy me. Whereas when you have a home fry, if you boil the potato in advance or if you just cook it through, it's going to have that perfect soft cooked potato quality all the way through.
I guess what you're saying is that the specific type of potato interior softness in a home fry is different from the interior softness of hash browns.
Yes, that is what I'm saying.
Okay.
Do you agree?
Yes. I agree that it's different. I think you're right that the interior in home fries is better than the interior in hash browns.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that if crisp is really your top concern, hash browns are going to get you more crisp.
Mm-hmm.
They have a higher surface area to volume ratio, more exterior that's exposed to the frying surface. And if they're just spread thinly enough, you won't get much of that interior.
I think that's true. And maybe where you and I part ways is that for me, my top priority in a breakfast potato is not Christmas. I agree that Christmas is very important, but what I want in a breakfast potato is something really like hearty and filling. To me, I think of breakfast potatoes as the part of brunch that is most beneficial if you are suffering from a hangover. And to me, brunch is very much tied to being this sort of cure, this antidote to hangovers. It's supposed to like make you feel as though things are okay when you've woken up hungover. I don't really drink that much. I mean, I realize that like, I'm sounding like I have a drinking problem.
No. Although you did write something to me in one of, we were emailing back and forth about this. You wrote, when you are hungover and haven't had enough coffee yet, you don't have the energy to take bites out of a giant wedge of potato.
That's true.
That makes you sound like you get really drunk.
Well,
I mean, how drunk do you have to be, Laura, to not have the strength to bite through a larger wedge of potato?
It's not about the alcohol. It's about the coffee. If you haven't had enough coffee, and I'm someone who drinks a fair amount of coffee on a daily basis, like it's very difficult to do things when you haven't had your morning coffee.
And like so, bite a potato.
Like bite through a large piece of potato. And let me clarify what I meant when I said that, which is that I am of the opinion that home fries should be no more than 1 inch in diameter. Preferably, I think, a little bit less than that. Sometimes home fries are really, really large. I think that
one
home
inch,
fries
well, hang
should
on,
be...
Hang on, though. We're talking about a cube.
A cube, okay.
So you're saying 1 inch on each...
On each side.
On each
you're right.
Side.
Diameter was not the correct
geometrically sound here, Laura.
So what is the correct mathematical geometric
you want
term?
You want your home fries to be 1 inch cubed.
That's true, yes. 1 inch cubed is the maximum. I would say preferably they should be less than that, but they should be not so big that you have to take multiple bites in order to eat a piece of it. You should be able to stab a piece, put it in your mouth, chew, not feel like your mouth is overloaded with potato. I think ideally they should be smaller because then you can stab a home fry, stab a little bit of your egg, maybe stab, I don't know what else you have on your plate, maybe like a salad or something, put it all in your mouth. And when you get like a nice
that's not going to help your hangover.
No, it's not. But it is good for you.
Right.
So
forkability.
Forkability.
And the ratio you're going to get in a bite mm-hmm. when you're combining with other things, these are concerns.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's just like it's a very common mistake that home fries are too big.
Oh, really? See, I think more often they're too small. I mean, I you say 1 inch cubed. That to me, I mean, that 1 inch cubed, those are big home fries.
Well, but you agree that that's, you know, you can put a 1 inch cubed in your mouth.
Well, yeah, sure. But to me, most home fries are usually like the size of playing dice.
Oh, no. I wish that most home fries were the size of playing. I mean, maybe I need to go to the restaurants that you're going to when you're getting these playing. To me, playing dice, that sounds perfect. That sounds like the, as long as they're crispy on the outside, that sounds like the perfect home fry.
I'll get back to the breakfast potatoes discussion with Laura Anderson in just a minute, but I want to tell you guys just a tiny bit more about these ridiculous, delicious prize packs that I'm giving out right now. Three lucky Sporkful listeners are going to win. To enter, just sign up for the Sporkful mailing list in the right-hand column of Sporkful.com. I won't send you a bunch of spam. I won't share your email address with anyone else. I won't bother you too much. Just once in a while, I'll send you some links of fun stuff to make your world more delicious. That prize pack again includes Love-Grown Foods Oat Clusters, Tasty Brand Fruit Gummies, which I wanted to try, but my daughter ate them all because they look ridiculous. Mary's Gone Crackers, Pop Chips, and gift certificates for Evol Burritos. Plus, you get a copy of the book in which all of those foods are featured. That book, again, is called Cooking Up a Business, Lessons from Food Lovers Who Turned Their Passion into a Career and How You Can Too. It's by Rachel Hofstetter. It's a great book. It's super interesting. And all these foods are super delicious. So sign up for the Sporkful mailing list by midnight, New Year's Eve. The sign-up is in the right-hand column of Sporkful.com, and you will be automatically entered to win. And check out Cooking Up a Business by Rachel Hofstetter. Let's talk a little more about the right size of the home fry cubes. I put a few of these questions out on Facebook. Eater Bill Smith writes, nice small dice on the fresh potatoes. And then he adds, on the potato cut, uniform size so you don't end up with super crispy chips and mushy white goo. All of it needs to end up a nice G, B, and D. Which I Googled. I was like, what's that? And I came up with green building and design. I was like, that's not what that is. So I wrote back to him, and he said it's short for golden brown and delicious.
Oh, I had not heard that either.
Well, neither had Google,
that.
So I think Bill's the one who's flying solo on that.
GB&D.
Yeah, but what do you think of Bill's uniform size postulation? Should all of the cubes be the same size?
Generally, yes. If there are some pieces that are smaller, as there will be because a potato is not a cube or a rectangle in itself, it has, you know, rounded edges. I think slightly smaller pieces are fine, and you get a super crispy piece every now and then. But most of the pieces should be the same size.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I mean, I think what I would say is it's okay if there's size variation as long as those biggest pieces are all crispy enough. Mm-hmm. So you want like 3/4 of the pieces to be just the right level of crisp and 1/4 of the pieces to be extra crispy.
Yes,
but you don't want a few big old clunkers that end up soft.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of size variation we don't want.
I think that technique in the way that you cook them has more to do with whether they turn out crisp than the size of the chunks. Sometimes you are getting home fries that have been apparently like sauteed on some kind of skillet, but without very much oil, and they're just kind of like soft all over, and maybe they have like some spices on the outside, but like they're just like soft boiled potatoes basically, and those are not real home fries, I think. Those do not deserve the name home fry.
Yes, they are neither home nor fried.
Right.
Well, talk to me about how they should be cooked.
Well, I think they should be deep fried.
Not fried in a skillet.
They could be fried. Okay, they could be shallow fried. There should definitely be a lot of oil because that is what you need in order to get them really crisp. And I think boiling, you're parboiling the potatoes ahead of time is not necessarily a bad idea. You do definitely want them to be soft in the middle, and it's hard to get, especially if you're doing like a skillet frying, a shallow frying. It's hard to get them to be soft in the middle.
It
takes forever, yeah. So I think parboiling is probably a good idea.
Is there a possible downside to parboiling?
I don't think so.
It seems to me like that's just the way to go.
Yeah.
I mean, someone on Facebook said microwave them, which, I mean, mm-hmm. I guess if you're in a rush, but I mean, it doesn't take that long to boil them for 5 or 10 minutes.
Right. Or like steam them if you don't want them to get too waterlogged. I mean, microwaving seems okay to me, but I do think that there should be some kind of seasoning on the outside, like paprika, some kind of spice in addition to salt and pepper.
You say paprika?
Mm-hmm.
Not paprika?
I say paprika.
Interesting.
You say paprika.
Yeah.
How do you say the nut that is spelled P-E-C-A-N?
I say pecan pie.
I say pecan.
Well, I say pecan pie, but if I'm eating them as solo nuts, I say pecans.
Really? I say pecan.
But you're from Texas. That's a Texas thing, I think.
You think pecan is a Texas thing?
I think that's a Southern thing.
Maybe.
I think like Paula Deen would say pecan pie.
Maybe. Did you just compare me to Paula Deen?
I'm afraid I did. Sorry. I retract that.
How would Paula Deen say paprika?
Not only are you from Texas, which is technically not really the South.
Right. It's a whole different
region. But you're also a vegetarian. So you and Paula Deen are...
We are different.
In many ways.
Yeah. anyway, paprika, yeah. I think that there should be some...
But wait, I'm not letting you off the hook there. Because my wife's whole family is from Czechoslovakia,
uh-huh.
where paprika is like, I mean, it's like water. It flows
right
out of the faucets there. They have, every dish that my mother-in-law makes ends in the word paprikash,
mm-hmm.
and they say paprika. So, mm-hmm. and my mother-in-law's family is from Hungary, which is like the home, the real home of paprika.
Mm-hmm.
So
you're saying that I'm pronouncing it wrong?
That's what I'm saying.
Okay, well, I will take that under advisement, but I'm probably not going to stop saying it paprika.
Let's continue talking about texture, Laura. As I said, I put this question out on Facebook. A lot of folks just said crispy, crispy, crispy. And I mean, you're not going to get much of an argument from you and I, but not everyone was quite as rigid. Valerie Mae Wheats writes, crispy hash browns with sliced American cheese melted on top. You can argue that it makes them soggy, but the crispy edges and the gooey, cheesy center is delicious. So she doesn't mind adding something that's going to cut into that hash brown crisp a little. And Penelope McKibben says, fry in a round skillet with a combination of olive oil and garlic butter until nicely browned and crispy on both sides. None of this crispy top, gooey bottom nonsense. So she's making an important distinction
she's
there.
She's talking about hash browns.
Hash browns, but she's saying that they need to be flipped.
I would agree with that. I imagine you would, too, if you like them crispy.
That's right. And this was one of my issues. And folks in the New York area, or even if you are going to be here anytime in the spring, summer, or fall, there's this thing called Smorgasburg in Brooklyn that is phenomenal. It's this outdoor sort of food fest that takes place every weekend, and there is a lot of great food there. And there's the hash brown stand.
I've never been to the hash brown stand.
Oh, it's really good. And you can get all sorts of things. You can get like a sunny side up egg on top or meats or a lot of different options.
Oh, that sounds good.
But they don't flip the hash browns.
Ooh.
Yeah.
the hash browns should be flipped. But, you know, time is a factor in a thing like that. People are walking around, they're coming up, they want their hash browns. So,
right. And and also just traditionally you have hash browns maybe served in a diner, you have shorter cooks, you know, people who are processing a lot of orders. So I think that probably the tradition of not flipping hash browns came from needing to turn out a lot of hash browns very quickly.
That's true, but they also can sit on that griddle for a long time. So, you know, I think a good short order cook walks in the door and throws potatoes on the griddle and then lets them sit there. And then by the time they're ready to eat, they're ready to rock.
I would agree with you.
In fact, someone on Facebook was saying that that they used to wait tables at a diner and that the potatoes there were only really good when it was run by a husband and wife. Mm-hmm. And when the wife stood over the husband and made him take time with the potatoes and made them sit on the griddle, then they'd be really good and crispy. But if she wasn't watching, he would get impatient and take them off prematurely.
And time is really important with potatoes. It's important with a lot of things. It's important often when you're trying to get something crisp, but you can't rush breakfast potatoes.
One more quick question for you on texture, Laura, sort of an etiquette question before we move on to other things you might put with the potatoes. Is ordering them extra crispy permissible, or does that make you a difficult diner? I mean, I always feel like people who order French fries done to a certain temperature, it's a little bit like, you know, you're asking a lot. I mean, maybe if you're talking about steak fries in a fancy steakhouse or something, okay. But, you know, at a diner to order your fries well done, I mean, you know, I don't know. But are breakfast potatoes any different?
I would probably not order breakfast potato extra crispy. I don't think it's necessarily a problem if you're polite about it, but I think you should be open to the possibility that if you order your breakfast potatoes extra crispy, they're just going to come back to you the way they always are, and your waiter is going to say, oh, here are the extra crispy potatoes, even though they're no different from all the other potatoes that are being turned out by the restaurant. As long as you don't send them back. I mean, I don't think it's wrong to make that request, but I think it's also understandable if a restaurant at a very busy brunch hour does not feel obligated to respond to all these special requests, if it's not related to, you know, being allergic to something that's going to kill you.
Right, right. If death is on the line.
Right. I mean, I don't know. Maybe you do feel as though you're going to die when you get undercooked breakfast potatoes. Right.
Let's move on to things you might put into or on breakfast potatoes. First up on the list have to be peppers and onions.
Ooh.
Where do you stand?
I'm really anti-pepper.
Okay.
Bell pepper, you know, I think that is, it has no, it's soggy, it's wet, it just has no place in a mix of breakfast potatoes. Onions, I'm okay with. I guess that would be mainly with hash browns. It's hard to, I guess sometimes you get home fries with onions mixed in. But, you know, anytime you're adding a moist vegetable to fried potatoes, it's going to make them soggier. And so if you value crispness, it's a real trade-off.
I think that's right. And then I think the other thing to factor in with bell peppers is that they have a strong flavor, stronger than many people give them credit for.
And they kind of get bitter. They seem particularly bitter when you eat them next to potatoes for some reason.
Yeah, I think onions are a more natural complement. Mm-hmm. I agree. But you don't need onions.
No, you really don't. You really don't. So yeah, I'm generally against.
Now, at the Waffle House, you know, and other places like Waffle House, they have all these different kinds of options. You can get them. They have all these terms, you know, smothered and whatever. They have a whole long list of adjectives. It means you can get them with cheese, onions, mushrooms, meat, you know. To me, like, at its core, as we've said, the potato dish is meant to be crunchy and salty. So, like, if you want to turn the potato into a base for some other dish that's going to have meat and cheese and eggs and all these things on top of it, that could be good, but that's going to quickly cross the line from side dish or accompaniment to entree.
I agree. I'm thinking of...
I mean, it serves a different purpose.
It does. It does. I don't think it's bad. I mean, look, you can't really go wrong if you have shredded or otherwise crispy potatoes topped with melted cheese. Like, that is just a delicious miracle of nature. But I think you're right that it becomes more of a main dish, and it's delicious, but it's different from hash browns and it's different from home fries.
I mean, this is a larger conversation. This gets into when you talk about poutine or chili cheese fries or any time that you're putting toppings on crispy potatoes. like you said, it's a trade-off, and I think it's one people need to be putting a little bit more thought into.
Mm-hmm.
To me, I think most of the time you're better off just getting these ingredients separately on the plate and combining them on a per-bite basis.
Mm-hmm. You have more options that way.
More options, than it maintains the crisp.
Yeah.
You know, you can add, if you get like a cheese omelet, all right, and a side of potatoes, you can combine the cheese and the eggs and the potatoes in each bite, and the potatoes will always be crispy until they go into your mouth. If you potatoes covered with eggs and cheese, the potatoes won't be as crispy.
I think that some people like the parts of the potato that get soft and maybe a little bit soggy when they come in contact with cheese or other ingredients. I like that under certain circumstances.
Well, Laura, this is sort of like, you know, the poutine epistemology that I've identified here before, which is, you know, are the French fries, cheese curds, gravy supposed to meld together into this sort of cohesive mush, as many poutine lovers argue, or as I have argued, it would poutine be better if you got the gravy on the side so that the fries stayed crispy, and then you fork the cheese curds and fries and dip into gravy on a per-bite basis, thus maintaining crisp.
Is that poutine or is that fries with a side of gravy?
Well, that's the question, and that's the question that I'm asking you with regard to breakfast potatoes, mm-hmm. is, you know, at what point are you no longer eating hash browns? At what point is this some kind of like a breakfast mountain?
Breakfast mountain.
You know, so I think that's a question people need to be asking themselves.
I think so, too. I think that's something that people should be asking themselves every day.
we're doing the big work here on the Sporkful.
I would agree that it becomes something else very quickly. I think that, I don't know, like once you, is it, but if you put cheese on top of hash browns, are they still hash browns or do they immediately become something else as soon as you put something on top of them? I would say they're still hash browns, but you might disagree.
I'll give you cheese.
Cheese is just so basic.
Right, right. I mean, cheese is like...
Everything should come with cheese as an option.
If you start saying that every time you add cheese to something, it becomes something else, we'll have nothing left but cheese.
Right,
do you know that I had Peter Sagal of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on this podcast, and he said that the fact that melted cheese makes a food better is an indication that there is something not so good about that food. It's a backhanded compliment to the food.
I strongly disagree with that.
Go ahead. Take on Peter Sagal, Laura.
I think that cheese makes things better. That doesn't mean that those things are deficient in any way.
All right, we'll take that, Peter Sagal. Laura Anderson, a.k.a. L.V. Anderson, Slate's food and drink editor and author of that long-form piece that I'll link to on Sporkful.com. Folks can follow you on Twitter at...
LV_Anderson.
Anderson, E-N.
O-N.
O-N. I always get that wrong.
Oh, really? You get my last name wrong?
I mean, all Andersons I struggle with.
Well, you know, it's true. Yeah. We're a confusing bunch.
Yeah.
Yes, LV underscore Anderson with an O.
All right. Laura, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me, Dan. That was a pleasure.
Hey, folks, remember to connect with me and The Sporkful. I'm on Twitter at The Sporkful. On Facebook, like The Sporkful at facebook.com/Sporkful. That way you can keep in touch with all sorts of cool links and things. Of course, the website is Sporkful.com, and I'd love to get your emails at dan@Sporkful.com. Thank you so much for tuning in. Until next time, I'm Dan Pashman, reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better.